tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Tens of thousands of people marched in demonstrations across the United States Saturday to protest President Trump's zero-tolerance stance on illegal immigration. AP's Julie Walker reports.
John Legend performs at the L.A. rally, telling the crowd he brought his family with him and wants people to understand how important not just family is, but also doing something for others. In New York, Kerry Washington, whose grandparents were slaves and immigrants, says the fight against the Trump administration's policies is very important to her.
It's not enough to just end family separation. We have to end family detention, and we have to reunite these families.
In the nation's capital, Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda sang a lullaby dedicated to parents who were separated from their children.
When you came into the world, you cried, and it broke my heart.
I'm Julie Walker.
A monitoring group says satellite images show rapid improvements have been made in recent months at one of North Korea's nuclear research sites. This comes from a report by the group 38 North, which monitors military, economic, social, and other developments in North Korea. Meanwhile, the Trump administration says it does have a plan for denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. AP's Ben Thomas.
President Trump's national security advisor says the U.S. has a plan that would lead to the dismantling of North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs within a year. John Bolton tells CBS's Face the Nation that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will discuss it with North Korea in the near future.
It's to North Korea's advantage to see these programs dismantled very quickly, because then the elimination of sanctions, aid by South Korea and Japan and others, can all begin to flow.
Ben Thomas, AP Radio News.
And this is VOA News. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs Susan Thornton is leaving the State Department at the end of July amid ongoing and critical negotiations with North Korea. This is weeks after the leaders of the U.S. and North Korea met in Singapore. Thornton was formally nominated by President Donald Trump as Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs last December, after serving in the position in an acting capacity soon after Mr. Trump took office. Thornton's nomination, which requires Senate confirmation, has been blocked by key Republicans. Two French soldiers were killed in an attack in Mali Sunday. That's according to the Defense Ministry. At least a dozen others were wounded, including between four and eight French soldiers, when a car bomb detonated, reportedly targeting a French and Malian patrol, which then came under fire. The attack comes just days after Islamist militants raided the headquarters of a five-nation African force. A suicide blast has ripped through members of Afghanistan's tiny Hindu and Sikh minority in the eastern Nangarhar province, killing at least 15 people and wounding 20 others. The victims were on the way to the governor's office in the provincial capital of Jalalabad Sunday afternoon to meet with President Ashraf Ghani, who was visiting the city. Canada's retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods take effect this Sunday following the Trump administration's new tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland said the tariffs are regrettable, but called the U.S. tariffs hurtful.
These Section 232 tariffs are illegal under WTO and NAFTA rules, and we have therefore initiated cases at the WTO and under Chapter 20 of NAFTA to challenge them.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and U.S. President Donald Trump spoke late Friday to discuss trade and other economic issues. Trudeau also spoke Friday with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto to keep him up to date on Canada's response to the U.S. tariffs. The American goods that Canada has placed tariffs on include ketchup, lawnmowers, and motorboats. Mexico's presidential election Sunday is shaping up to be a historic poll plagued by corruption and violence, but voters in the nation appear to be heading to the ballot box with sweeping change in mind. Polls consistently show the left-leaning Andrés Manuel López Obrador, widely known as AMLO, with a double-digit lead. Voters are also picking candidates to fill 128 seats in the country's Senate, in addition to 500 seats in the Chamber of Deputies. That's the country's higher and lower legislative bodies, respectively. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The president has called on the Anti-Corruption Bureau because he said the president was not aware that some of the donations that were made into this Democratic Progressive Party account came from people that were being investigated.
Malawian President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika denies corruption allegations.
The ACC Act of 2008 clearly provides for exit declarations as well. So we are still waiting for members of the last administration, the former President Nkrumah administration, to declare their exit assets.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio declares his assets.
People are scared, and it's not just women, because women do not live in a vacuum. The people who love them, the people who depend on them, are scared. And it's not even just women who are getting killed. An MP was gunned down on the street.
And the U.S. and French ambassadors joined protesters in the Ugandan capital Kampala Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Malawian President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika has denied accusations of corruption following a leaked report from the Anti-Corruption Bureau. The report recommends that the president should not be prosecuted due to his immunity, although he benefited from a $200,000 deposited in his account he solely controls. But the anti-corruption agency has dissociated itself from the allegation, saying it has since launched an investigation into the leaked report. It came after the vice president recently said corruption in the government has reached embarrassing levels. For reaction, I reach Ngemi Kalilani, spokesman for Malawian President Mutharika.
What we are seeing here is a sponsored conspiracy that is aimed at character assassinating the president. The facts of the matter are as follows. The Democratic Progressive Party has a construction project to build a party headquarters, several offices actually across the country. And it opened this bank account to collect donations to go for this particular project. And there are several deposits that have been made to this particular account from donors. The bank transaction that is being referred to in this particular so-called leaked document is one of the donations that was made into this particular Democratic Progressive Party account. And money from this account has always and only been used for the purposes of the party. The so-called report makes mention of an amount of 65 million kwanza, which they alleged that the president had made a series of cash withdrawals amounting to that amount. That is not correct. There is only one check amounting to 65,500,000, which the president made from the account, and it was payable to a council, a local council here called the Branda City Council, in payment for a plot which the party had purchased as property on which to build the party headquarters in question.
Ngemi, I understand where you're coming from. However, the leaked report and the reaction from Malawi suggests that the vice president's call that corruption has reached the higher echelons of power in Malawi, this backs that call, and that the president's hands are not clean as he claims to be. These Malawians are saying that the president himself is corrupt. How do you react to such criticisms?
Not at all, but we are not surprised with that observation. That's why I have told you, it's you that you have brought up the issue of the vice president here. The vice president who made such comments has been serving in this government for 4 years. This is actually the fifth year. He has been part and parcel of the government. At what point has he realized there is corruption in the government? Has he realized that there is corruption in the government during fifth year, when we are now going for elections next year? We all know they are politicians. They're in competition, but I think there are better ways of competing politically. Malawians would be served better if our politicians engage on matters of policy other than mere mudslinging that is not helpful for the country.
Some critics of the president are saying for somebody who is close to power to come to tell Malawians that the government is corrupt, then they should believe him. What do you say to that?
If someone makes an allegation that this government, in which I am part of, is corrupt, I think an honorable thing that a person would do if he's making such an allegation seriously is to first step aside and say, I have resigned, there is corruption in this government, and provide evidence. And we've called him several times to say, could you please provide the so-called evidence pointing to the corruption that you have been alluding to? That has not been done. If anything, what we see 2 days later is this so-called document from the Anti-Corruption Bureau, which purports to connect the president to some flawed business transaction in the police service. And the Anti-Corruption Bureau said, no, we don't know anything about this document.
Monday, the DPP officially begins its convention to either confirm President Arthur Mutharika as his presidential candidate for next year's election, or if somebody decides to compete against him, do so. Will the president be confirmed? And two, is he going to choose a new vice presidential candidate?
We know that prior to this convention, there was a heated debate within the party. We had a group of people in the party that were asking or agitating for the vice president to take over the leadership of the party. It got too hot for them, and the vice president chickened out of the race. So as it stands, the only name we know at this point in time is that of Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. No one else has come forward yet. As to the question of who the president would decide to become his running mate, I think that would be a question for another time. We still have some 11 months to go.
Will the president allow the Anti-Corruption Bureau, without any fear of political pressure from his office, to thoroughly investigate the president over allegations of graft?
Definitely, yes. The president has actually said so. The president has called on the Anti-Corruption Bureau because he said the president was not aware that some of the donations that were made into this Democratic Progressive Party account came from people that were being investigated. The president did not have this information. And the president has said, can the ACB professionally investigate this matter and follow where the evidence take them to? No one will be spared, and no one should influence the ACB in as far as this transaction is concerned. The president has said he is personally interested to have this matter taken to its conclusion, to find out what really happened about the business transaction which this particular document is talking about.
Ngemi Kalilani is the spokesman for Malawian President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio has declared his assets a requirement enshrined in the Constitution. The president submitted his asset declaration form to newly installed head of the Anti-Corruption Commission, Ben Kaifala. President Maada Bio has since called on senior government officials to emulate his example. The country's laws demand that public officials declare their assets within 3 months after coming into office and do the same after leaving office. But critics say the president took too long to declare his assets, particularly when he promised to champion the fight against corruption. For reaction, I reach Mohamed Rado Soare, the Sierra Leonean Information Minister in the capital, Freetown.
Remember, during the campaign, we ran a robust campaign on an anti-corruption platform. He promised to lead by example, and therefore his declaration of assets within the first 90 days as per the provisions of the Anti-Corruption Act of 2008 is a move in the right direction. Remember, Sierra Leone has had very despicable positions on the anti-corruption rating for successive years. This is a strong commitment to show that it's a new day and it's no longer business as usual.
How will this asset declaration help the president in his promise to Sierra Leoneans that he is going to weed out graft in the echelons of government and society in general?
This is just one of several instruments at the disposal of the presidency and the executive to weed out graft from public police. We have, amongst other things, taken other practical steps. We have promised to strengthen the Anti-Corruption Act by establishing special anti-corruption courts to expeditiously try and prosecute corruption-related offenses. Apart from that, he has also promised to look into the terms and conditions of public servants to ensure that they get living wages to put their above corruption, so that corruption becomes a vexatious issue for every Sierra Leonean, because this has held our country back since independence. We want to ensure that funds and proceeds lost through corruption are brought back to address key issues in social service delivery, in education, electricity, pipeline work, and others. So this is a very serious concern for this government. And President Bill is fed up. He is very committed. Make and show less willing to carry this crusade of an anti-corruption regime.
How soon will Sierra Leoneans see other public officials that he appointed to declare their assets as enshrined in the Constitution?
Well, His Excellency has made it categorically clear he is leading by example, and following his declaration, he called on all other public officials, especially his appointees, to follow his good example. I will be declaring mine in the next coming days, so will the other ministers and other political appointees.
Talking about asset declaration, some Sierra Leoneans are saying that the previous administration did not do that, and that the recent transitional handover note expressed a lot of concerns about previous corruption. How is the president going to tackle this?
First, the ACC Act of 2008 clearly provides for exit declarations as well. So we are still waiting for members of the last administration, the former President Nkrumah administration, to declare their exit assets. This is very, very important. This will enable Sierra Leone to see the clear blue water line between entrance assets and exit assets. That is very important in the fight against corruption. Yes, you mentioned the transition report. Very odious reputation issues have come up in the government transition report. We have heard about wholesale swindle of government resources, awarding fictitious contracts to friends and cronies of members of the last administration. We also note the undervaluation and undersale of government's 30% shares in the then Sierra Rutai Company, which was very profitable, as a song to one of former President Nkrumah's cronies, and a lot more. The transition report is going to give us a lot of insight into the things that went wrong, into the binding constraints that have held this country back, into the things that have kept, you know, drugs out of our hospitals, that have kept our kids sitting on the floor during classes. All of those things are going to be laid bare and clear in the transition report.
How will the president guard against the perception, or perhaps the act, of going after his perceived political opponents or those that disagree with him, using this transitional report supposedly to witch hunt them?
Well, President Bill has made it clear several times that he is president for the whole of Sierra Leone. He said it during his swearing-in ceremony. He reiterated that at the inauguration, and his every move since he became president has underscored the fact that he has an open mind, he's detribalized, he's a nationalist. He only does what is best for Sierra Leone. But let us note, when crimes and criminals are prosecuted, they bear no colors, they bear no region. So a group of people should not use that as an indication to blackmail this government not to run after corrupt state criminals. Because we believe that corruption has hemorrhaged this country, corruption has cost this country a lot of good. So we are going to pursue state criminals. In fact, the transition report is recommending further investigations of corrupt state criminals. So this is important for us, with a view to recovering looted resources, ill-gotten wealth, and other assets of the state confiscated by private individuals.
Mohamed Radu Sware is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. U.S. Ambassador Deborah Malak and French Ambassador Stephanie Revoir joined protesters in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, Saturday. The protest was aimed to demand action from the authorities following the recent surge in the kidnappings and killing of women. According to the Ugandan police, at least 43 women have so far been murdered, while many others have been kidnapped for ransom since May 2017. Opposition and civil society groups have accused the government of failing to find solutions to the crimes against women. For more about the protest, I reach Lydia Namubiru, one of the organizers from the Women Protest Working Group.
Ugandan women and their allies took to the streets. And the background to that is that over the past 2 years, 43 women have been reported dead, and they're often found to have been brutalized in a very misogynistic manner prior to their death. They are raped, sticks are wedged into their genitalia, they're kidnapped. Some of these women are sex workers. Many of them are just vulnerable, low-income students, children who are vending on streets and that sort of thing. So, but the protest itself was mostly attended by urban Kampala women who wanted to use their own voices, their own visibility to draw attention to the fact that these murders and the ongoing kidnaps have never been satisfactorily addressed.
Supporters of the government are saying the president has weighed in on it. The police and other security agencies are acting on it. Do you think the government or the authorities have done enough to address this concern that you're expressing?
I appreciate the fact that the president has weighed in and the security chiefs organized a sort of unheard of conference, joint media appearance to talk about what they're doing. But at the same time, too often, issues, matters of life and death, are responded to with mere promises, with mere speeches. So we wanted to show the government that this isn't just the women who are killed and their families who care. A larger section of the public cares and is watching this and will be looking to see if what you say you're doing even gets done. But at the same time, I think what the president proposed falls to the left of what is at the heart of the issue and why these matters happen and remain unresolved, which is that the Uganda police fails miserably at community policing, fails miserably in its relationships with communities, and therefore fails to get witnesses, fails to get information from communities that would resolve these issues. None of that can be resolved by a lot of the measures the president was saying, truck, motorcyclists, ban hooded sweatshirts and that sort of thing. That's not really what the problem is.
Lydia, I understand women protesters in Kampala are still demanding action and accountability for the rampant killings of women, and that women are now afraid to even move from one place to the other in the country. Is that the current situation in the country?
Yes. I mean, even just reading the placards people were carrying, and one gentleman was carrying a placard that said, "I am marching because when I tell her, text me when you get home, I mean far more than the surface. I'm marching because text me when you get home means far more now." So yes, people are scared. And it's not just women, because women do not live in a vacuum. The people who love them, the people who depend on them are scared. And it's not even just women who are getting killed. An MP was gunned down on the street. The police spokesperson was gunned down on the street in broad daylight. And again, every time, especially when the big murders happen, you get speeches, you get promises, but no real reform of the police force and the police's methods of operation.
The U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Deborah Malak, and French envoy, Stephanie Rivoal, were present at the protest. How significant was this, and did their presence draw attention that you needed to pressure the authorities to act expeditiously?
We were very surprised to see them, delighted to see them. And I think this is, in the build-up to the march, we're asking everybody, bring your privilege. The reason these murders remain unresolved is that the victims are often low-income. They do not have your kind of privilege to draw attention to be listened to, bring your privilege. So I do think the two ambassadors really, really use their privilege in a very heartwarming manner. Does that mean the government will now pay more attention? I hope so. We hope so. But that's yet to be seen.
Lydia Namubiru is one of the organizers of the Ugandan protest. She spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Rebels loyal to former South Sudanese Affairs Vice President Dr. Riek Machar have accused the government of attacking their positions. The attacks, they said, undermines the new ceasefire agreement. The ceasefire forms part of a signed peace agreement between President Salva Kiir and the former Affairs Vice President on Thursday. But officials of the government deny the accusation, saying the rebels are to blame for launching attacks against the National Army in four states. For more, I read Attorney Wek Attorney spokesman for the South Sudanese President.
First of all, this is a false accusation, given that the SPLA forces are actually undergoing the implementation of the presidential order to strictly observe the ceasefire. Therefore, our forces are actually on a strict orders. When the peace agreement was signed, the framework peace agreement in Khartoum, President Salva Kiir immediately issued a decree ordering the army to cease hostilities and to remain in the barracks. The attack yesterday, PLM IO forces, the SPLA forces in Wau, and they have also attacked Eastern Lagi State. The attack came from Penyijar on the other side, closer to the border of the former Unity State. So the attack came from there, in a state of saying that it is the government attacking them. There's no only reason.
Lam Paul Gabriel, the spokesman for the SPLIO rebel, says the South Sudanese army, supported by pro-government militia, attacked rebel positions in the northwestern village of Mboro near the border with Sudan. How do you react to this?
They have not been there before. The forces that were in Mboro are actually government forces, and the attack came, you know, outside Mboro, that is in near the Sudan border. The attack came from outside against the government forces. You know, the truth of the matter here is that whenever there is a ceasefire between, you know, signed between the government of South Sudan and the opposition forces, owing to the fact that they don't belong to a solidified leadership, they tend to continue to operate against the whole odds. So it, you know, government forces have no reason. There's no any commander that can risk the order of the president. But the truth of the matter is that most of these forces are loose, and therefore they are subject to attack the SPLA forces, you know, without any provocation. And this is what I wanted to tell you.
Why is it that anytime the two sides sign an agreement, there appear to be a breakdown of it? One side accuses the other side of violating the peace agreement. Why is this so? This is not the first time a peace agreement has been attempted to be signed and things have flared up once again. It is the poor people of South Sudan.
You know, the rebel, whenever information comes about government, as government is, they will fool the international community to believe them. And therefore, you know, they are not subject to any control. Whenever the peace agreement is signed or the cessation of hostilities is signed, opposition forces moved towards the areas controlled by the government in an attempt. And when they come and talk to international community that, you know, we have been attacked, the international community believes them, you know, because the language that has been used all the time, because many people lack knowledge of what, say, two sides is actually involved in violating the cessation of hostilities, as if two sides are actually capable of effecting any sign truce, you know, simultaneously. The opposition forces do not belong to any solid, you know, leadership, and therefore they are the one who are on the loose and susceptible to make attack.
Some are calling on the African Union, as officials meet there, to put pressure on both President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar by imposing sanctions. What is your reaction to that?
President Salva Kiir is the victim in this, because the fact that majority of international actors do not know exactly who are these opposition leaders and what is their personalities. You know, that's why whenever something happens, people think that Salva Kiir should also be blamed. Salva Kiir is a victim. So President Salva Kiir appending the Khartoum framework, and he means, you know, business. But the attack came from our side, and the detractors of President Salva Kiir think President Salva Kiir should also be blamed.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the spokesman for South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from the capital, Juba. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. It's knockout stage at the World Cup in Russia, of course, with no team from Africa. Senegal Taranga's Lions lost against Colombia 1-0, making it the last African team to exit the World Cup. Senegal were the last remaining African team in the competition after Morocco, Egypt, Tunisia, and Nigeria were eliminated. The West African team required only a draw with Colombia, but could also have squeezed through to the last 16 in the event of a defeat, depending on the result of the other group game between Japan and Poland. When already eliminated Poland stunned Japan 1-0 and Senegal suffered a 1-0 defeat, it left Japan and Senegal with the same points and the same goal difference. Eventually, the West African country was eliminated due to having worse disciplinary record than their direct rivals. Senegal's elimination on fair play rules not only made World Cup history, it was also the first time since 1982 an African team failed to reach the tournament's second round. Only three African teams have ever reached the quarterfinals of a World Cup. A Roger Miller-inspired Cameroon in 1990, Senegal in 2002, and Ghana in 2010, who were denied reaching the semifinals by penalties and a Luis Suarez handball. The only World Cup light on the horizon is that the number of African teams will increase from 5 to 9 in 2026 as the tournament expands. In athletics, Ethiopian Salomon Barega leads the loaded 5,000-meter field in Lausanne in the IAAF Diamond League. Having notched up two Diamond League victories already this year, Barega will aim for a third at Athletissima in Lausanne on July 5th. The world indoor 3,000-meter silver medalist will contest the 5,000 meters in Lausanne in what will be his final race before heading to Finland to defend his title over the same distance at the World Under-20 Championships. Barega, still just 18 years of age, won the 2-mile event in Eugene last month and then triumphed over 5,000 meters in Stockholm. He followed it up with a win in the 3,000 meters in Ostrava. In Lausanne, he'll be up against a field that includes world champion and last year's Lausanne winner, Mokhtar Idris, Olympic silver medalist Paul Chelimo, and Berhanu Belu, the Bahrainian who won in Shanghai and finished a close second to Barega in Stockholm. Ethiopia's Abadi Hadis, Eritrea's Aaron Kifle, and Switzerland's Julian Wanders are also in the field. And Gudaf Segai heads a strong women's 1500 meters field announced Friday by organizers of the Lausanne Athletisma, the 8th top Diamond League. The 21-year-old Ethiopian clocked a lifetime best of 3:57.64, the year's second fastest time, meeting races in Ostrava and Madrid. The challengers include Caster Semenya, the world and Olympic 800 meters champion and world bronze medalist over 1500 meters last year. The 27-year-old South African improved her lifetime best in her last two appearances over the distance, first to 4:00.71 to take the Commonwealth title on April 10th, and then again to 3:59.92 to win in Doha. Laura Meir of Great Britain, the world's indoor silver medalist, who has collected run-up finishes in Eugene and Stockholm, will also race. The lineup also includes Shelby Holhan, the Eugene 1500 meters winner, and Moroccan Rababe Harifa, who has a 3:59.51 lifetime best set in Eugene in late May. Sifan Hassan of the Netherlands, the 2016 World Indoor Champion, was also announced. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
zangu salamu wangu mimi mwambia meshakuwa nahitaji kukua kwanza we na mume utambe na uringe na mimi we na mke ili unichunge naro nuru yako kama mbala mwezi na ufuru macho yako kama na machozi peruke 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 mama peruke peruke na pendeza peruke 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 na pendeza.
want $1 million. Say make a wire, wire. Tell me to undercover, my girl. He say all our friends, friends. Leave me la vida loca. If only me, my lover.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is becoming painfully difficult to determine whether peace will soon return to South Sudan. The 4.5-year-old conflict has caused enormous difficulties and problems for the people of South Sudan, and many of them have left the country and have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Many efforts have been made in the past to see whether peace could be restored, and all of these have failed. The problem in South Sudan has been an embarrassment to all men and women of goodwill who supported the South Sudanese in the struggle against the government of the Sudan, and they hailed their independence as end of that struggle. But the political class in South Sudan has failed not only the people of South Sudan, but their colleagues around the world. And now another attempt is being made to find peace in South Sudan. At the invitation of the Prime Minister of South Sudan, of Ethiopia, President Salva Kiir, and the opposition leader, Riek Machar, met in Addis Ababa to find ways and means to reach an accommodation. From there, they moved on to Khartoum, and under the auspices of the government of the Sudan, they announced last week that they have reached a framework agreement that called for complete ceasefire and also for the establishment of humanitarian corridors and the exchange of prisoners of war. The difficult issue of governance is postponed for the future. The problem is that although South Sudanese have praised this agreement, there are others who take into account that this is the 9th ceasefire agreement, and others have failed. And they either are cautiously optimistic or downright skeptical. The reason for the skepticism is due to the fact that there are rogue elements in South Sudan who appear not to want peace and prefer domination. Even while President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar were meeting in Addis Ababa, the Minister of Information of South Sudan, without indicating whether he was speaking for himself as a person or the government, affirmed that Riek Machar would not be allowed to be part of the government of South Sudan. He allowed that he could designate a representative. This was made after it had become very clear that it was a folly to keep Riek Machar in South Africa either under house or hotel arrest, because his loyalty of his supporters remained. So the future will tell us whether these rogue elements will seek more cooperation and to bring succor to the country. If they fail to do so, then the international community, through the United Nations Security Council, must contain to apply targeted sanctions against them. They must know that it's better to give peace a chance. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a monkey that eats grass instead of banana is a goat. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Bahabazi Primary Health Care Center in Nepal, which was severely damaged in the 2015 earthquake, is the first health facility that was rebuilt with U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, funds. In mid-June, U.S. Ambassador to Nepal, Elena Teplitz, in partnership with Minister for Health and Population, Upendra Yadav, turned over the newly reconstructed Bahabazi Center to the people of Sindhu Palchuk District. This $1.8 million reconstruction project was made possible due to the support of the American people. The project, which included constructing two new buildings, renovating an existing building, and fully equipping all buildings according to Nepal's Ministry of Health and Population Standards, was implemented by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers under a contract with Creative Builders Concern Limited. Due to the large number of patients it serves, USAID and the Ministry of Health and Population identified this health facility as a high priority for reconstruction. The 15-bed facility provides primary health care services to a remote population of 112,000, including vulnerable infants and mothers suffering from high-risk pregnancies and deliveries. Since the 2015 earthquakes, the U.S. government invested more than $190 million in Nepal's earthquake response and recovery. USAID has trained more than 15,000 engineers, contractors, architects, masons, and carpenters on earthquake-resistant construction techniques and helped homeowners to rebuild over 16,000 homes using modern safety standards. In addition, USAID is in the process of rebuilding six more health facilities to improve access to quality health services to over 229,750 earthquake-affected people. During the handover ceremony, Ambassador Teplitz said, "For over 70 years, the United States and Nepal have shared a mutually beneficial relationship. The 2015 earthquakes caused unimaginable devastation, displacing families, destroying schools, and damaging health facilities. It is in difficult times like this that a helping hand means the most, and we are proud that the United States was able to demonstrate our deep friendship with the government and people of Nepal in this time of need."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.